Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is F. Leonard Myers, author of Tears in the Rain. Tears in the Rain is a story of the tragic impact of the silent and little understood epidemic of narcissistic revenge and parental alienation. Is the story experienced by thousands of innocent children and targeted parents caught in the destructive intersection of pathological narcissism and toxic divorce. Len received an MBA from Boston College, an MS in public administration from Northeastern University, and has his BA from Colorado State University. He worked in outdoor experiential education in New Hampshire and Massachusetts and taught several courses for the Educational Psychology Department at Boston College. Later, he worked in the high-tech industry as a general manager with Marshall Industries, distribution manager at Dallas Semiconductor, and a global distribution manager at Syncor before retiring due to multiple sclerosis. Len co-authored a book on experiential education with Dr. John Dacey at Boston College, and again is the author of his newly released novel, Tears in the Rain. His book is available at Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Len to the show. Good day, Len.
Good day. Thank you, Robert, for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, it's my pleasure. And, you know, I'd like to start with, first of all, since this is your first novel, what led you, what was the inspiration behind the novel? What kind of led you to write a story about this particular topic?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I think of that myself a lot. And I think the reason is that my wife, Tammy, and I lived through this experience for 10 to 12 years, and we didn't know what was happening. We saw a change in her daughter, and I came in here to join Tammy when the girl was four, and as she grew, we noticed these changes and saw them, and we couldn't put our finger on it, couldn't identify it, but we knew something was wrong, and we suspected that there was something going on with the relationship between her and her father. And ultimately, when she was about to turn 14, we got the court notice that he had filed for a change of domicile. And that's when everything kind of came together, and they said, oh, my God, if we only knew then what we knew now, we could have prevented this. And then I started to do research and found that there's so many people out there that have the same thing happening to them. They don't know they know something's going on, but they don't know what it is. They don't know what's causing it or how to stop it, and they end up losing their children. And some of them lose all of their money trying to just hang on to their children. So I decided that it would be cathartic for both of us if I wrote the novel, and I did research and ended up doing it for the catharsis and also to really try to do something that would help other people learn to identify this kind of problem before it gets so bad that it's irretrievable. Because I believe that, like I said, if I knew then what I knew now, I could have stopped this. I could have saved the child. But I didn't, so I couldn't. And hopefully somebody else can.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm absolutely confident that, you know, the book will help. I mean, just having read it, it just I mean, I was able to identify with some of the aspects myself, and then also, I think, as far, for the reader, it will certainly raise awareness, and once awareness is raised, then, from there, at least, there's the possibility of taking action and becoming empowered and that kind of thing. So,
right.
But now, why the title Tears in the Rain?
Well, there's a reference in the book to it, too. It's kind of a the child alone suffering through this whole process is conflicted very often. It's very conflicted by the whole thing, and the cries for help are just lost. They're lost in all the noise of our society, of all the noise of everybody saying this and that. And the reference is, it's like tears in the rain just washing away. The tears just get lost because of all of the noise around them. So, tears in the rain.
Yeah. It was fitting, yeah. And that particular reference in the book, mentioning a child in crisis, alone, scared, and desperation, looks like tears in the rain. So, but and that's, I think, probably one of the biggest challenges of this kind of environment is the fact that so many aspects are unseen. Because of that noise, like you call it, noise that surrounds it all.
Well, it really is that it's unseen and unheard. I look back at this, and I can remember an instance where when Julia, who's the character in the story and actually my stepdaughter, took me aside one day when she was about 6 or 7 years old, and she said to me, "Len, it's more fun being at my dad's house." And she was asking me about that, if it was okay. And I responded the wrong way. I said to her, it's okay. You should be having fun at your father's house. You only see him on the weekends. And the home here is where you have to have responsibility and yada, yada, yada. So have fun at your father's house. But I realized later that what she was saying to me, that she's being told that his is the fun house, ours is the bad house. And isn't it more fun to be with me at my house, and wouldn't you rather live here? And I miss that. I miss that whole point. And that sticks with me. It's 10 or 12 years later now, and it still sticks with me. I wish I had picked up on it. And that's why you say, why did I write it? That's why I wrote it, to help people pick up on things.
Yeah, in that case, I can understand, your reaction, to her, with that kind of situation. You want your child to be able to be happy, and the fact that, there's this split household or the split kind of situation, you really don't want to add to the stress, that they're already, going through. So right. I can understand that. But like you say, there is that aspect of, that little clue. But then again, you didn't know that until hindsight, right? It wasn't until much later.
Right. And most people aren't looking for that, because most people, even in a toxic divorce, most people want the best for their children, and they try to keep their children insulated so they're impacted the least amount possible. Unlike somebody in this case who, has a narcissistic personality disorder that really just goes into a narcissistic rage, and is trying to get revenge against his ex-wife for doing what he believes is some injustice to him. So the child becomes the weapon. It becomes a weapon that is used against the other parent.
Yeah, that's all too common, unfortunately. So, the phrase, the term parental alienation, I had never heard that before. But, before your publicist contacted me, I was like, what is that? You know, and so if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners, I think, you know, probably
sure.
many have experienced it, but having it identified as such may be new to them.
You know, and I'll do that, certainly. And it's interesting you say that because I had another experience just earlier this week where a guy that I came in contact with through somebody else was having all of this happen to him within the last year. And he also had never heard the word parent alienation or parental alienation. And those of us that are working with it now all the time think it's so common. And that's the whole problem, that nobody seems to know that this is a real problem, but it's affecting thousands and thousands. And it's killing people. You know, there are people dying, committing suicide over this, parents and children, believe it or not. Anyway, parent or parental alienation, some people call it pathogenic parenting and those kinds of things. But it develops when one parent who is afflicted with a disorder, in usually a toxic divorce, decides that he or she wants to hurt the other spouse. And the best way to hurt that spouse is to deprive him or her from a warm, loving relationship with a child. Basically, to take that child away. There's nothing that can be more painful. Excuse me. So they go through a process, and it can be fairly quick, and it can be fairly overt, or it can be subtle and take a long period of time. But the whole process is getting that child to turn against the other child, against the other parent, and end up actually rejecting that parent, turning away from him or her, and cutting that parent out of their life completely. And that's really what happens. And the result typically becomes that the child starts speaking the same words as the culprit parent. They start thinking the same way. They almost become an extension of them. And the next thing that starts to happen, they start sitting in judgment against them and saying that you're not a fit parent, that you don't deserve, you know, to have me as a child or something like that. And in the book, you may have noticed it was an exchange of emails between the mother and the child. Those emails were vicious, and they were exactly as were written by the child to her mother. So it's a process of getting that child to hate the mother or the father and reject them, cut them out of their life, and it leaves the father or mother sitting there wondering, what happened? What did I do? How did this happen? I thought I was a good parent. I've tried to be a good parent, but now I'm being told that I'm a terrible person. And it tends not to be very well known because parents that are affected by this tend to be ashamed of it. They think it's their fault. They've been told it's their fault, so they believe it, and they go into isolation sometimes. And even their own families sometimes begin to reject them because very often the offending parent is a narcissist, and the whole idea of the narcissist is they build this false impression about themselves. And so many people think that this is a well-adjusted, well-spoken, well-educated parent, and he or she would never do anything wrong or do anything wrong to their child. So everybody seems to take their side, and the person that's affected the most by it goes into hiding, and sometimes they are destroyed by it, which is exactly what the offending parent wants.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about the narcissism in a little bit, but, you know, I mentioned knowing about some of this personally. You know, when I was growing up, my father left when I was young, and there was no contact. So, I mean, this is, in a sense, a little bit different from both parents kind of being active in one's life. But I grew up, you know, hearing all of the bad things about the missing father, and as a child, boy, I picked right up on that, and I, incorporated that anger and hate as well, until later in life when I finally met him and got the other side
wow.
of the story, you know.
Oh, good but, Lord. I know of two stories exactly like that. But the thing was that the father was trying to contact the child, was calling, and the mother would never put the call through, and he was writing letters. The mother would never send the letters through and never get it. So the child just assumed that the father had abandoned him, and the mother
mm-hmm.
reinforced that. And he never realized the truth until he grew up, and his fiance, his wife, said, "You have to invite your father." And after much resistance, he did. And when they met, they both cried. and
yeah.
the kid said, "Why did you abandon me? Why didn't you contact me?" And the father went on to explain, "I did. I kept trying, but I couldn't get hold of you. I was being blocked."
Yeah.
And anyway, it changed the relationship. But the poor boy grew up his whole life thinking his father had abandoned him.
Right, and I think, I think that's probably not uncommon, in one of those situations. So, personally, as I was going through and reading your book,
yeah.
I was like, well, I can identify with some of this, I understand, what that's all about, and,
yeah.
And again, it's just one of those things where, luckily, I was able to, change that situation around, later in life.
Mm-hmm.
But like you say, as a child, it makes an impact. I mean, it for basically all of my childhood, I had that abandonment, kind of alone in the world kind of a feeling. He didn't really try to connect because my mother
yeah.
said she'd kill him if he did.
Sure.
And he believes it. And she probably will.
It might be slightly different in that, it might not have been an active, campaign by your mother. But, it's
right.
interesting. My wife has this thing. She wants to call it the 1 in 3 challenge or something like that, because she believes that every family – or every individual in a family or a close associate or a relative is going through this same thing, and we may not know it about them. In other words, it's so much more common than anybody
yeah.
thinks. It's frightening.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that completely. Now, the story is a novel, but obviously, you have some of it reflects your life. And in the beginning of your book, you have the disclaimer, that names and characters are fictional and that kind of thing. But it seems to me that the situations that you put in the book are those that are very common, that many people would be able to relate to. And so it seems in that sense, it even though it might be fiction, there is a heck of a lot of truth to it behind it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to do. I wrote it as a fiction so that I could include more things and try to make it more illustrative of what this problem is really all about. It's based on some very, very real things, and a lot of the other things that I did add, or some of the characterizations or the places, I researched this thing pretty well, and they can all be pretty well substantiated.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that in the book, there was a divorce, and divorce can be probably a common circumstance that can trigger the revenge and hate kind of aspect in parental alienation. But in a way, though, doesn't some of that really maybe occur, like the groundwork is laid much before you get to the point of divorce?
Sure. That's a good point. You know, there's the good parent, bad parent, even when they're living together. You know, when my wife and I got married, her little girl was 4 years old at that point, and Tammy would oftentimes tell me stories about her and her older sister, who was also alienated, what would go on in the family. And there was definitely a competition between the father, who wanted to be the good guy, who wanted to be the hero, who wanted to do everything, and the mother, who was the bad person. But then the father would be inconsistent also, and might on the one hand be telling the mother, leave her alone, she's a good kid, leave her alone, but then the kid will get off and be up too late and he'll go crazy over it. So there's a lot of inconsistency and a lot of misdirection for the children, but clearly a competition between who is the good parent and who is the bad one. And again, the narcissist starts coming in, where the narcissist has to have the whole world revolving around him or her, and, you know, all paths lead to them and not the other way. So they have to be the center of attention all the time.
Yeah, that character, the father, Peter Webster, in the book, I know a few people. I don't know a few Peters in my life, you know. And, you know, it just seems that, you know, that narcissistic personality is kind of like really the ideal setting, for lack of a better phrase, ideal setting for creating alienation in, and not just in their children, but also people in general, too.
Yeah. Sure, and especially with children. You know, in the 1930s, I think Max Weber, you know, coined a term called charismatic authority, as the dynamic that allows cult leaders to recruit cult members. And again, it was charismatic authority. And you say, you take that and you now transfer that over to a family where who is more charismatic with a young child, more so than a parent, and who has more authority than a parent? So the whole thing is there to really just, you know, the children are so vulnerable, and if one parent decides to go down this road and take advantage of it and use their narcissism to make themselves feel more like the center of attraction, and it's so easy to do in many ways, and that's why it's so common, and it's devastating to the children.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I kind of want to talk a little bit now about, you know, the impact of that alienation on children. A couple of days ago, I had a gentleman, Dr. Dan Peters. He's got a new program.
I listened to
program.
Him.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you know, and his, you know, his big thing is the footprint, you know, that parents leave on children. So can you talk a little bit about the footprint that, you know, the alienation, what are some of the effects on children, you know, that this kind of behavior fosters?
Well, certainly one of the effects is that it creates conflict. And sometimes the children can bury the conflict, and one of the ways to bury it is to join one of the parents as opposed to the other, because they're forced to make a decision. But there's still something that is deep down inside of them that is a guilt thing. So they grow sometimes into a very depressive state. These children tend to be depressed. They tend to have physical problems. They sometimes have this burning rock in the stomach, which I describe in the story. It can explode at some point. But we also know that as they become adults, they very often remain dependent on the parent who has been abusing them. And they remain depressed. They have a lot of difficulty with healthy relationships. There's a lot of addiction and drinking involved, and there's a lot of therapy. So they never really adjust well, not just because they only have one parent, but because they have one parent that is doing so much damage to them and trying to do damage to the other parent at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to me it seems that, you know, the lifelong impact on relationships is probably one of the most destructive aspects to this. It's sad.
Sad. It's really sad, you know, and it doesn't go away. I can tell you, I don't know how my wife, Tammy, feels about me saying these things right now, but, you know, she cries almost every night still. And there's nothing that would make her ex-husband happier than to know that.
Yeah.
But she still cries every night at the loss of two daughters to him.
Yeah.
They don't talk to her. She has had no contact with them for over 2 years now. And she writes to the youngest one every day. She still sends a text or something every day, but she hasn't heard back from this child for over 2 years.
Wow. That is just sad. That is, it's for on both parts, you know. I mean, especially for girls to have such a, not to have their mother in their life. I mean, because that's such an important role model, you know, that is vital in their, you know, the relationships they're going to have with their kids when they eventually have them.
So if you're a child growing up and you don't have your mother as your role model, and then you've got this narcissistic father as another role model, who are your role models at that point? How are you going to grow up to be a healthy person? And by the way, we're talking about a father. I would like to add here, and it's kind of important, that the statistics show that 60% of the alienation that's done is done by women, by mothers. So it's not just fathers by any stretch of the imagination.
Wow. Really? That meant
yeah.
So the women trying to are alienating their children against their father?
Yeah, what will happen in this case, you know, typically the divorce happens, the children stay with the mother, the father goes away somewhere else. It's easier for the mother to do this because she's got them all day long. Now, the father may be gone and trying to visit with the kids, but she blocks them. And she tells them that, yeah, he doesn't want to visit you because he doesn't like you. He doesn't like me. He's a bad father. He's done this. He's done that. So the mother's actually, it's easier with a child who's living with the mother for her to alienate against the father. So it happens a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I need to be fair to men. You know, it happens more with women.
Yeah. Well, I know that firsthand. We're going to go ahead and I want to take just a quick break. And I do want to invite listeners that if you would like to call in and ask Len any questions or share your experience regarding this topic, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in there and we'll get to them right after the break. So, and then when we come back from the break, Len, I want to kind of start talking about some of the social structures that we have and whether they support or they're a hindrance to this particular phenomena, okay?
Sure. Very good.
Okay. Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there. Or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc. And we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, Also on the site is a link to the great products we provide. Books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again. Today, my very special guest is F. Leonard Myers, or Len Myers, and we're talking about his newly released novel, Tears in the Rain. And again, his book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link in the show page description to his book there. And I'll tell you, it's a 400-plus page book. And when I first got it, I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to have to try and get as much of this done as I can before the show. But it was one of the easiest reads I've had in many, many months. I was able to get through it very quickly. It might have been my personal experience, you know, that really wanted me to find out what happened next. But you know, if you're one in three people who is affected by this particular topic, definitely go there and pick up a copy. So, okay, with that, we're back. Len?
I'm here.
All righty. Okay, so in the book, you know, we basically talk a little bit about some of the support structures. For example, you know, the character Elaine Bond works for the Department of Youth and Family Services. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, in your research on this particular topic, what is the current, say, status of, you know, family services when it comes to recognizing this particular phenomena and being able to deal with it appropriately?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question and a long story, too. My experience and research kind of leads me to believe that there's been a tremendous failure by the mental health community, by the legal community, by the schools, guidance counselors. It's largely because people don't understand it. One of the key things is this, that psychologists don't see narcissists very often, even though it's considered within the a cluster B personality disorder. It's a serious disorder, but they don't see it very often because narcissists tend to imitate normal people, if you will, well-adjusted people. They're not well-adjusted themselves, but they imitate it, so they look good, and they think they're okay. They've built this false impression about themselves. They think they're okay, so they don't go for therapy. So psychologists don't see them very often, and their only experience is with their textbooks. So when we brought our daughter to three different psychologists, none of them could relate, child psychologists. They used play therapy and things like this. They had no idea that, and they didn't pursue that there was a family dynamic going on here between father and daughter. So that was turned out to be a waste of our time. My wife went to her daughter's current school when she first went there and tried to raise some issues. All they did was call the father in, of course, immediately tied everything and told them to stop talking with the mother. Schools have been a failure. Mental health, the community tends to have been a failure because they don't understand it or recognize it. The courts have been a terrible failure. And even though we didn't have a lot of experience with the court, we had enough to realize that they're not going to be helpful for a couple of reasons. One is family courts see so many terrible tragic sexual and physical abuse, that when we see a child who looks fairly normal and talks fairly normal and is saying, I want to be with this parent or that parent, and I just don't like the other one, they say, fine, get out of here, go do it, and all of that. The other thing is that in most states, or many states, our state here, I'm in Rhode Island, a child at the age of 14, can make their own decision with whichever parent they want to live with. And the only way it can be stopped is if there's, again, obvious sexual or physical abuse. So at age 14, a child's brain is just not well enough developed to do that. So, you know, we have just seen no help at all, really, from any institutions like school, courts, counselors, guidance counselors, or anything like that.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about, you know, the children and their desire to be with a parent who, you know, is the fun one, I mean, to me, it's like the Stockholm Syndrome, you know, of being sympathetic to your abuser.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Sort of like the Cleveland women or the Stockholm Syndrome. That's what I'm thinking of right now. They get sympathetic to the people that are abusing them, and we saw that a little bit with, and I've heard about it and read about it, where, you know, the child starts to be manipulated in many ways. And one of the things he or she is likely to do is start to feel bad for the parent who's doing the manipulating, because he or she might be saying, you know, I didn't want to get divorced. It was your mother or your father that was bad. And I was doing everything I could to raise you kids and to do this and to do that and do the other thing. And he or she was so bad, and yada, 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 yada. And the child starts to feel an association with the person who is actually manipulating that child to hate the other parent unjustifiably. And that part goes on. Then there's also the fear. There's a fear factor. We picked up at one point that the child was afraid. We don't know if it was afraid of being physically hurt, but afraid to disappoint the other parent, that, oh, he or she, you know, he would be so hurt if I don't go over this weekend. The girl stopped going to parties. She stopped going to sleepovers. She stopped having contact with anybody else in the family or even her own friends, because she had to spend every weekend with her father or he would be really disappointed and possibly angry.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and I just can see that dynamic happening. Now, you know, when you mentioned, you know, the court system and how they're just, you know, obviously inundated with cases. First of all, the fact that they're inundated with cases is tragic. I mean, you know, the fact that we have just so many that they have to kind of, you know, give a lower priority to those who may be, you know, emotionally abused. Are the courts, is it, you know, kind of basically the quantity of cases, or are there laws that, from what you've been able to determine, laws that need to be created or instituted, or, you know, because obviously a court is there to uphold the laws, whatever laws are on the book.
Right.
So, I mean, is there a need for legislation, maybe, in recognizing that as a viable, you know, need, that thing that needs to be given attention?
Well, I think that there does need to be some legislative changes, and, you know, for instance, changing the age when a child can just decide where the heck they want to go and live. I think that emotional abuse is recognized as illegal. It's recognized as an injury and so forth and so on. The problem is not so much the law saying that this is illegal and that it's abuse. The problem is identifying it and identifying it early enough that you can do something with it. And again, if the law says a child can change domiciles at age 14 and they don't recognize it until age 10 or 12, it's really too late. Because once a child starts to hate the parent, there's no law that's going to change that. You know, you can't can't legislate who you love and who you hate and so forth and so on. What I think needs to happen, this is my own recommendation, and it's very personal, it's not based on anything except my experience, is that the court needs to become more receptive to a parent requesting that there be an independent family evaluation as soon as the parent starts to recognize there might be something going wrong. In other words, don't depend on the lawyers because they're adversarial by nature. You know, that's how our court system works. So if a judge was to say, we need to get a forensic psychologist that will examine the family and try to pick up on whether there's anything going on here that's not right, I think that would help a lot. Because then when it goes into court, the forensic psychologist can testify as an expert witness that is really not for hire, so to speak, you know, by either one of the two parties. Now, we do have what's called guardian ad litems or guardians or whatever they're called. But our experience was that, and from what I'm hearing, they tend not to really help very much. And in our experience, we finally found a guardian that we were going to try to go to when the girl was 13 years old. And he said, he was actually pretty good. He was at Brown University. And he said, you know, I'm willing to sit down and talk with her and talk with you guys, but I have to warn you of something, that no matter what I find, unless I find, again, the sexual or the physical abuse, I am mandated by law to recommend that she go where she wants to go.
Yeah.
Even if he finds other things.
Yeah. See, now, that's, again, see, that's the thing I was kind of, you know, wondering or getting at. You know, the fact that he was mandated by law by those restrictions. You know, I mean, those are physical, you know, actions or results, you know, but it really just completely ignores the emotional aspect, which, you know, God, that is, I mean, that's what, I mean, physical scars, yes, they're bad, you know, they heal sometimes, but sometimes. Then, you know, the emotional trauma is so far-reaching, you know, and it's such a huge impact to me, it just doesn't make sense that it's not given equal footing.
Yeah, it's amazing to me, too, and it's also amazing because somebody had the foresight to put it in the law, to put it on the books, but nobody has seemed to come up with a way to really monitor it or manage it, and maybe it's because we have so much violence that they just don't have the resources to do everything that they really should do. However, you know, these kids grow up, and some of them will grow up to be violent. Some of them will grow up to be in prison, and it ends up costing society an awful lot to neglect them when they're very young, you know?
Yeah, you know? And the costs are just, you know, beyond that, you know, the cost to failed relationships, you know, and the amount of energy and the impact on one's happiness, quality of life, you know, is really also just as much. Boy.
And it just gets passed down generation to generation and spreads out. It just gets worse and worse all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it does. One of the topics that you also touch on, the main child, Julia, is in the book is kind of basically tries to commit suicide. So teenage suicide is one of the topics that you address in the book. And it is a huge issue. I mean, it's just really crazy how how big of an issue it is right now. And so can you talk a little bit about, you know, why you put that in there? And, you know, is maybe one of the causes, one of the contributors to that, you know, not just parental alienation, but also, you know, the individual alienation of our teens?
Sure. Let me say first that, you know, part of the reason I put it in is for creative purposes, to try to, you know, open the whole thing and have a basis for which to base the story. But I can tell you that, you know, right here in our own town, we've had two teenage suicides over the last couple of years that we know about. I know of other ones that may or may not be related to this kind of a thing. So, it, you know, teenage suicide, we don't know all the time what's causing it. I would venture to say that most, you probably would agree that most teenage suicides occur because there's something going on within the family. I know we talk a lot about, you know, bullying and that kind of thing, and I'm sure that's a lot of it. But a lot of it, if there was a really strong relationship between child and both parents, there would be much less of it. We know that. We know that also that these kids get torn apart, that get caught in these toxic divorces and these narcissistic relationships. They get so stressed by it, and it's so destructive to them that many of them do attempt to commit suicide. My wife and I were talking with a woman recently on the phone, and she reached out to us after the book came out, and she was telling us she lost her son. It was so hard to listen to, that she lost her son who got caught in the middle between her and his father. And you're just sitting there saying, somebody's ego caused this child to kill himself. And it makes no sense. And I may have gotten off your particular question for a second, and I apologize.
No, not at all. You know, and again, like, you know, you're the example of a couple in your city happening. You know, you just hear about it often. And yes, you know, cyberbullying or bullying, you know, can, I'm sure, contribute to some of that. But the one thing that, you know, because as I was reading the story, you know, one of the things out of over the years, last 6 years I've done the show, I've had several people who have talked about suicide, the topic of suicide. And it seems that one of the most important aspects to helping someone who may have suicidal thoughts is a connection, is a personal connection, you know, and, you know, and since the, you know, this idea of alienation, you know, in your book, you know, came up, it just seemed very representative of, you know, today's society where kids, even though they're connected, so to speak, you know, in the cyber world, they're, is certainly a lack of personal connection this seems to be really important.
And they're certainly getting less and less connected to their parents, because at the end of the day, they still need parental guidance. They need to be able to go to someone, no matter how tough the relationship is. And good Lord, we all have had tough relationships with our parents from time to time when we were growing up. But I can remember myself, I had the advantage of at least being able to go to my mother and father when things got really bad, and at least they'd listen to me, even if they didn't know what I was talking about. They at least sat there and listened to me, and I always felt that there was protection there. And I get this sense that kids today, a lot of children, they just don't feel protected in their families. and they need to feel protected. And
if
they get caught in a situation like this, there's not only no protection, the parents are tearing them apart. At least one of the parents is actually causing their destruction.
Yeah, very much. Now, you know, we've talked about how parents, you know, create the hostility and try and alienate child from another parent. You mentioned your stepdaughter has a sister. Is there, when it comes to children, you know, who have siblings, the multi-children families, you know, is there, you know, in your experience, have you come across where maybe alienation is, quote, more successful, you know, with some children than not, and maybe what are the characteristics of children who may be less susceptible to the alienating behavior?
You know, that's interesting you ask, because there actually is another child in our family. It's, again, my wife's daughter. She's third daughter. She's the middle daughter, and she still lives with us, although, well, she's 22 now. She's in China in college. But, she never became vulnerable to it. And we've often tried to talk about this. Why? A couple things come to mind. One is that she is much more of a street child than the other two, in that, not that she's a, you know, a tough street kid or anything like that. She's just pretty savvy. And also, for some reason, she bonded with me more than the younger one did, although I was fairly close with the youngest one. This one really did bond with me, the middle child, and we're still very close. And so I was able to replace the father in this whole situation. But she's streetwise, she's sharp, and she is more, I think, emotionally independent. The younger child has always been more shy, quiet, a little bit, withdrawn. And I always thought she was more vulnerable to influence from another person who was really trying to influence her, because she didn't have a strong enough self-esteem to really stand up and take care of herself that way.
Okay.
Beyond that, it's really hard to say.
Well, that makes sense, though. You know, again, for parents out there who are, coping with this kind of situation, you know, it's if they want to try and empower their children, to be, less susceptible, the idea of strengthening that self-image strength would be certainly the way to at least empower the child, so that they're less susceptible.
That's a good point. Absolutely, they need to feel strength. They need to learn to stand on their own. But we see kids, seniors in high school today, that can't stand on their own, that depend on mommy and daddy for almost everything still. We seem to be raising, I started to talk to like my father now. We're starting to raise children that just can't take care of themselves. And that's really too bad, because they have to. And they have to learn very young to start taking care of themselves.
I have to say that I now understand why in your book the children were adopted from China with your the middle daughter there being in China. I see the China connection, so to speak.
There is a China connection, and it's interesting you bring that up, because that leads to a whole other issue. Somebody's going to say, oh, they're Chinese kids, they're not your bio. Well, the oldest child is biological. The youngest child is Chinese, and the middle child is Chinese. So there's no real connection here. I don't think, you know, in terms of it all.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can be alienated and some kids can avoid it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I agree. Yeah. So one last question.
Sure.
In the book, you have an organization called ECHO that is like a support. Okay. So I went to look it up and see, is there such a thing? So is there such a support kind of group for that kind of thing, or is that something that we, you know, should look into having formed?
Unfortunately, that's my wishful thinking. That's my creation.
Okay.
You know, I'm laughing because somebody called me the other day and asked me if another character was real. You know, they wanted to contact them. But Echo, no, it's not that I know of, but you know what? That's what they need.
Right.
We need something
yes.
like that. Survivors of parental alienation that can, you know, create a support group. Not necessarily to do what Echo does in the book, but, you know, just to support and help and try to get these people through these really, really tough times. The other thing I want to add, I know we're getting toward the end of it, is this, that if a parent starts to recognize that something's weird when the child is young, there probably is something weird going on, and don't fool around with it. We went through long, long years of bringing our child to, you know, psychologists, to pediatricians, to this and that and everything. I would say try to find a forensic psychologist that the court will say, I want an independent evaluation done by this person that's not aligned with either side, the lawyers don't get them, that the court orders it, and let that forensic psychologist come into court and say, this is what I read, this is what I interpret is going on.
Great. Boy, that's great advice. And so I guess, you know, in closing, is it that you hope, well, first of all, I think SOPA, Supporters of Parental of Alienation, is a great organization to start. So in I guess, you know, in closing, is your one of your goals of writing the novel to really just raise awareness and maybe empower the readers who are going through this?
Yeah, it's really been to raise awareness, empower people, and certainly if, you know, if I can be of help to anybody in any way, I'd be happy to. They could reach me through, you know, Facebook, which is my Facebook page is tearsintherain.10. I have a blog just called tearsrain.com, whatever. And there are support groups out there. There's quite a few of them on Facebook. And if they look up parental alienation on Facebook, there are thousands of people on Facebook that are going through this same, thousands, literally
yeah.
thousands. There's one group in Texas I know, the woman who runs it, I believe her name is Wendy Archer, and I believe she has 9,000 members
wow.
in her group.
Wow.
That's just one group, 9,000.
Yeah.
It's North
That's
Texas Parental Alienation Chapter, yeah. So
yeah.
There's a lot out there.
Well, it sure is. Well, Len, I really want to thank you for your time. I've enjoyed your conversation. It's an important topic, and again, your book was a wonderful, easy read, so I certainly recommend it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, and I wish you luck. I'm glad it worked out well for you also.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Len Myers. We've been talking about his book, Tears in the Rain. And again, you can find his book at Amazon.com. And I do have a direct link in the show page description to his book there. So definitely go there and pick up a copy. If it doesn't affect you, you can rest assured there is someone in your life that it does affect. So it would be a great gift to help those people that you want to help in your life. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me
That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.